Okay, good morning, everybody. File 241, and it is November sometime already. November 6th. How's that? You guys can hear me okay? Okay, so we were in the muscle chapter. Turning some of these lights down. What do we like? I'll leave that one on. Turn that one off. And we'll continue with that. But I guess maybe I'll ask you a question first. What's the structural and functional unit of contraction called? That's a sarcomere. That's right. If you know how a sarcomere works, you pretty much know how all skeletal muscle and cardiac muscle works. We're going to go into a little bit more detail, but just think of that sarcomere as being a very important building block. All right, so the sixth today, we should be starting blood, heart, and circulation, but we won't. We're going to finish up muscle. And 1 week from today is exam number 3. And then we're supposed to have chapter 13 on that exam. I'm going to have to send you an email over the weekend. Maybe I can break chapter 13 down into a couple bite-sized pieces. I'm not quite sure what I'm going to do with that. But I just don't want to dump it on the last exam because there's 4 chapters on the last exam already. So that's all I know at this point in time. Hopefully we can make really good progress on this muscle chapter today. That's all I know about that. Okay, so here you see some sarcomeres, right? See a nice electron micrograph. Got to get my pointers working. Okay, nice electron micrograph. And just to review, the endpoints of a sarcomere are these Z lines or Z disks. And there's a dark band in the center when it is relaxed, when the sarcomere is relaxed, and we're going to call that the A band. Then on either side of the Z disk where we only have actin myofilaments are very thin, so they don't block a lot of these electrons, so it looks a little bright. That is the I band. And this particular picture shows sarcomeres in 3 different lengths of contraction, or 3 different kinds of contraction. So this top row is when it's relaxed, the middle row here is when it's beginning to contract, and then the very bottom row is when the sarcomeres are fully contracted. And one thing that you probably notice is that these I bands disappear when the sarcomere contracts. So that's an important feature that you should realize when you look at these pictures, okay, that the I bands disappear. And what does that mean? That just means that actin and myosin are overlapping each other, and everywhere in the sarcomere you have a myosin molecule, so it looks dark. So let's look down at this illustration. Again, we can see the Z lines or the Z disks. And what protein is attached to the Z line? The actin, yeah, because you see it's the thin filament. All right, and then the myosin is right in the middle of the sarcomere. And remember last time we talked about, well, which of these proteins actually shorten when the sarcomere shortens? So you can look at the length of an actin and a length of a myosin and compare its length, right, at these various stages of contraction. And what you'll notice if you get your ruler out is that these actin molecules don't change their length. So the actin molecule in condition 3, fully contracted, is exactly the same length as in condition 2 when it's beginning to contract, and condition number 1 when the sarcomere is relaxed. And the same thing for the myosin. The length doesn't change. The only way that we can explain how these Z lines get closer together or how the muscle contracts is that these filaments slide over each other. And that's what we call the sliding filament theory of contraction. Right, so that's a theory. We all believe that. We all know that to be true. So let's look in a little bit more detail on how these filaments slide past each other. And we're going to have to break down actin and myosin in a little bit more detail in order to see that. So let's look at the actin molecule first. You can see that it is made up of a bunch of globular subunits that we call G-actin. Right, so these are just subunits that are put together. Right, and then there are 2 of these filaments that are twisted around each other to make an actin molecule. Right, so here is actin, or the G-actin subunits. We see some other components on the actin filament, or actin myofilament. There is another long molecule that we call tropomyosin. And tropomyosin fits right into a ridge on the surface of the actin molecule, or right on the surface of all the G-actins. And you're going to see that that tropomyosin is blocking a binding site when it's in this configuration. Also associated with tropomyosin is going to be a troponin molecule. And troponin is a cousin molecule to calmodulin. What do you remember about calmodulin? It has something to do with calcium. Calcium binds to it, and then it changes the physiology inside the cell somehow by activating or inactivating enzymes. All right, and we're going to see how troponin, which is a cousin molecule to calmodulin, how it activates muscle contraction. All right, so that is the actin myofilament. You got those three parts. You got the globular actins, you got tropomyosin, and you got troponin. And troponin has the ability to bind calcium. And when it does, it causes a conformation change in troponin. And it pushes and pulls on tropomyosin and causes a conformation change in tropomyosin. All right, so all these structural changes then change the function of this actin molecule, and it is all due to a calcium binding to troponin. All right, let's consider myosin. So here's the myosin molecule, and we can see that it has some projections, like some spikes sticking off of it. These are what we call cross bridges. And in the bottom case over here and over here, I don't see that this cross bridge is bound to an actin molecule, but it has the ability to do so. So let's look at this cross bridge. And we see that this cross bridge has a couple components to it. It has the myosin tail, and it has a myosin head group. And the myosin head group has some features on it as well. The myosin head group has a binding site for ATP, so ATP can fit into this receptor site. And also within the myosin head group, there is an ATPase. There's an enzyme. Not only is there an active site, but there is an enzyme that can break ATP down into ADP and inorganic phosphate. And then it will harness that energy to cause the conformation change in this cross bridge. The other component that we see is that there is another active site on the myosin head group, and you can see it as a bulge, and that is the binding site for actin. So the binding site for actin is on myosin. All right, and this head group also can hydrolyze ATP, and that releases energy, and that's going to cause a conformation change in this cross bridge. Can you see there's a almost like a 90-degree bend in this cross bridge when ATP binds to it. But after ATP hydrolyzes, do you see a conformation change in this cross bridge? What's happening? It kind of straightens out. So as a matter of fact, what you might want to think of is, let's call this the extended position, and this is the flexed position, right? And ATP you're going to see is necessary for these conformation changes. The other thing that you notice is that when ATP is hydrolyzed, now the myosin head group is actually bound to the actin molecule. So the actin binding site on myosin has bound to the myosin binding site on the globular actin. So now there is an association between actin and myosin. And this molecule, the cross bridge, is going to interconvert between this extended form and this flexed form. And when that happens, the filaments will slide over each other. I'll need some more pictures to show you a little bit better detail. All right, so myosin can't bind to actin unless it is cocked by ATP. All right, so after ATP is bound to the ATP binding site, it's hydrolyzed, and the myosin cross bridge goes into this extended position, and then it has the right position to where it can bind to the actin molecule. And when it's bound, it still has ADP and inorganic phosphate in the active site. When inorganic phosphate is released, that's when the cross bridge changes conformation, goes back to this flexed condition. And when it goes to this flexed condition, it's going to pull the actin molecule over the surface of the myosin molecule. So I suppose you could just think of your biceps brachii with a weight. Okay, when you flex your biceps brachii or contract your biceps brachii, what happens to that weight? You lift it up. Okay, so but instead of holding a weight, right, in this particular case, then that biceps is connected to the actin, and it's actually going to pull the actin over the surface of the myosin molecule. So this is what we call the power stroke. This is what's going to actually force actin and myosin to slide over each other. And the signal for the power stroke is the release of inorganic phosphate from the ATP binding site. So the question here that I have for you, just to see if you're tracking along with us pretty well, after inorganic phosphate is released, what's left in the binding site? ADP. Yeah, so ADP is now in the binding site. And as a matter of fact, the myosin head group is still attached to the actin molecule. So these two molecules are still associated with each other. So we haven't looked at the whole cycle of cross-bridge formation, right? This slide here just basically shows you what the power stroke is and what it's due to. It's a result of the release of inorganic phosphate. And that inorganic phosphate comes from an ATP molecule that's hydrolyzed. And you know what hydrolysis is. Okay, so here is the whole cross-bridge cycling. This is how filaments slide over each other. All right, so here is the thick filament. Here's thin. And I don't see troponin and tropomyosin on this figure because it's not important for what we want to discuss. But in real life, they would be there. So here we have the cross-bridge. Here's the head group. There is the actin binding site on the myosin head group. Here is the active site for ATP, and you can see right now that ATP has been hydrolyzed. So we have ADP and inorganic phosphate. When that happens, right, when ATP binds, right, and is hydrolyzed, then the cross-bridge, then this binding site can bind to the actin molecule, and now we have that association between the myosin head group and the actin. And then when inorganic phosphate is released, this cross-bridge goes from an extended form to a flexed form, and what do we call that if it's attached to this actin molecule? If the myosin head group is attached to actin and it goes from an extended to a flexed condition, we call that the power stroke, right? That's what's going to pull actin over the myosin molecule, and that is the direct result of the release of inorganic phosphate from that binding site. Causes that conformation change. Okay, then ADP is released after the power stroke, so it gets us to this condition. So ADP has been released, and so now you have an empty ATP binding site. Now what else do you notice on this particular part of the illustration? Is the myosin head group attached to the actin molecule, or has it dissociated? Take a look at this. Here is the actin binding site on the myosin head group, and it is still touching the actin molecule, which is different than what we see up here on the top part of the slide, right? So here, myosin is dissociated from actin, but down over here, we still see myosin is still in contact with the actin molecule. All right, well, how does dissociation take place? Well, here's another ATP. As soon as another ATP molecule binds to the myosin head group, that's what causes the release of myosin from actin, and we end up in this condition up over here. So a really good question is, what causes dissociation of myosin from actin? And then you would want to say the binding of ATP to the myosin head group. All right, so what happens if there's no ATP left in the cell for whatever reason? Maybe it's lost its blood supply, or maybe this muscle was exercising really heavily and it used up all the ATP. What state is this muscle going to be in if there is no ATP available? The cross bridges will always be attached to the actin molecule. It cannot release. So ATP is necessary for the release of myosin from actin to get to this condition over here, right? And then when ATP is hydrolyzed, that takes us back to this initial condition, and that causes the flexed myosin head group to extend itself once again, right? And when it's in this extended form, it's in the right conformation to bind once again to this actin molecule, but not at the same location, right? Because the first location was over here. Now here's the second location, a little bit farther down on the actin molecule. Right. And then the myosin head group will attach itself when PI is released, inorganic phosphate is released, then it's going to go through the power stroke. Right? And then this cycle will repeat itself over and over and over again. And so for every power stroke, one ATP is used up. All right, so some questions would be, what causes the power stroke? That would be a good synopsis item for you to know. What causes the power stroke? The release of inorganic phosphate. What causes the dissociation of myosin from actin? The attachment of ATP, right? So ATP is necessary for the dissociation. ATP is not necessarily needed for the power stroke, right? What's necessary for the power stroke? Just the release of inorganic phosphate. But of course, you don't have inorganic phosphate and ADP in this active site unless there's some ATP to begin with. But I want to break it down into the components. So the binding of ATP causes dissociation. The power stroke is caused by the release of inorganic phosphate. Yeah, that's really important. And when the muscle cell is resting, there is no association between myosin and actin. All right, so here's how it's controlled. So here we have the troponin complex. You can see the globular actin molecules once again, and this really long tropomyosin molecule. And in this particular case, there's no calcium floating around and through the myofibrils. And so the tropomyosin is covering up the binding site for the myosin head group. It's covering up the binding site. So myosin can't bind to actin. Okay. And this is the condition when calcium is low inside the cell. And when is calcium low inside the cell? Usually, whereas in a typical cell, where is calcium at a high concentration? Outside. Yeah, it's almost zero inside the cell. That's why it can be used as a signaling, as like a second messenger. All right, so calcium is released into the myofibril. Right, and in this particular case, we have a relaxed muscle. Here is the tropomyosin molecule. Here's the troponin. And you can see that the tropomyosin molecule is blocking or hiding the active site for the myosin head group. Right, it's underneath the tropomyosin molecule. But when calcium concentration increases, it binds to troponin, and it changes the conformation in troponin, and it pushes tropomyosin out of the way, and it reveals the binding site for the myosin head group. All right, so now there is an association between myosin and actin in the presence of what ion? Calcium. So is calcium important for muscle contraction? Yeah, it's a signal for muscle contraction. Without calcium, muscles just won't contract. Because why won't muscles contract without calcium? What would be a good way to describe why that is? Why is calcium necessary? Because with calcium as a signal, it can remove tropomyosin from covering up the binding sites. Right, so when calcium is high, it just reveals the binding sites on actin so that myosin head can bind to it. All right, so without calcium, muscles can't contract because actin and myosin can't associate with each other. Tropomyosin gets in the way. All right, so I guess I could ask you a question. You're familiar with a disease process where a person runs low on calcium and they lose calcium from their bones, and as a result their bones get brittle. What is that condition? Osteoporosis, that's right. And if we're lucky enough to live long enough, all of us will have to deal with that condition to some degree or another, but especially women, and especially women with smaller bones. Okay, and that's because as we get older, we have a harder time absorbing calcium from our diet. That's one of the reasons. And as we get older, we don't exercise quite so much, right? And that will help protect our bones to some degree. But as our bodies are running low on calcium, where would you choose to put calcium if you had a choice? In bones to make them strong so you don't have osteoporosis? Or would you put calcium in muscles so that they can contract? What would be more important? Muscle contraction, right? Like especially for the diaphragm, for instance. So your body makes that same decision as well. So that's sort of the rationale as to one of the reasons why osteoporosis happens, because there are other more important uses for calcium than just making bones strong. although I'm sure we all would like to have strong bones as we get older. Okay, so how does all of this relate to each other from a nerve impulse? How does a nerve impulse control calcium levels inside of a myofibril, which then controls cross-bridge cycling via this troponin and tropomyosin arrangement on an actin molecule? And that's what we call the excitation-contraction coupling mechanism. So here is an illustration from your anatomy book. I think you're familiar with this already. So I see a nice muscle cell, and here's the cell membrane of a muscle cell that we call the sarcolemma. If we look inside this muscle cell, I see mitochondria, which makes a lot of ATP, for instance, for muscle contraction. But ATP is necessary for what part? What part of the cycle of muscle contraction? This is kind of strange. What part of the cycle of muscle contraction is ATP necessary for? It's for the dissociation of actin from myosin, right? Not the actual sliding, but just the dissociation of actin and myosin. Right, so all these mitochondria are there. These are the organelles for contraction made up of many sarcomeres. Okay? And what do we call these organelles of contraction inside of a muscle fiber or muscle cell? These are myofibrils. So I like to think of a myofibril sort of like a mitochondria, but mitochondria make ATP. The myofibril contracts. That's what its function is as a as an organelle inside the cell. And you can see that there are many myofibrils inside this muscle cell. You can also see that this muscle cell is multinucleate, right? Because during development, these were all individual myocytes that fused together to make this one really long fiber or muscle fiber. And I can see some holes in the sarcolemma. These holes are continuous with part of the cell membrane that goes deep inside the cell. And last time I mentioned that on the whole surface of this skeletal muscle, there are special kinds of channels that open up. And these channels on a neuron you have located on an axon only on the axon. But in a muscle cell, you have these kinds of channels in the neuromuscular junction and over the whole cell surface. Anybody remember what kind of channel that was? Okay. As a matter of fact, what are the two main kinds of channels you're aware of? How are they controlled? The two main ways that channels can be controlled. Voltage-gated and ligand-gated. All right. And what do you find on an axon of a neuron? Voltage-gated channels, that's right. As soon as the membrane changes voltage, these can open up, cause depolarization or excitation. Well, we have voltage-gated channels over the whole cell membrane of a muscle cell and even under the neuromuscular junction, so that when a nerve impulse comes down from a somatic motor neuron, it triggers those voltage-gated channels even within the synapse or neuromuscular junction to depolarize. And that causes an action potential that flows over the whole muscle cell because there are voltage-gated channels everywhere. So here is an action potential moving over the cell surface. That electrical event, right, cannot enter the cell because it's stuck on the cell membrane. Right, so there aren't any electrical changes deep inside the cell, but there's a specialization that we see on skeletal muscles that allow action potentials to go very deep inside the muscle fiber and, as a matter of fact, everywhere inside. And these are what we call the transverse tubules. So here are transverse tubules, which is part of the sarcolemma, right, which actually projects down into the interior of the cell. So when there's an action potential on the surface of the cell, it can then travel through these T-tubules because the T-tubules have voltage-gated channels, and the action potential then basically flows everywhere on the inside of the cell and the outside of the cell. So T-tubules are important for allowing action potentials to enter the interior of the cell. Right. But I see on top of the T-tubule and on the bottom of the T-tubule, I see another tube, something that looks like a structure. These tubes right here are part of the smooth endoplasmic reticulum inside of this muscle fiber. And what kind of functions do you remember for smooth endoplasmic reticulum way back? They're a reservoir or a storage area for calcium. So there is high calcium inside of this sarcoplasmic reticulum because there are calcium pumps, calcium ATP pumps, that are always pumping calcium from the cytosol and from within these myofibrils back into the sarcoplasmic reticulum. So calcium is being pushed back into these, into the sarcoplasmic reticulum. So it's at very high concentration. But when an action potential comes down the T-tubule, that causes calcium channels to open up. And when all of a sudden there is a hole in the sarcoplasmic reticulum that's big enough for calcium to leave, guess what calcium likes to do? It just moves by diffusion from high concentration to low, and it's a huge concentration gradient, which means that the rate of diffusion is very high because the concentration gradient is high. Okay, so these parts of the sarcoplasmic reticulum and one T-tubule, we call that a triad. The part of a sarcoplasmic reticulum that abuts one of the transverse tubules on one side, that's just what we call a terminal cisternae, but you can see that it is a network of sarcoplasmic reticulum that surrounds every myofibril. It's just that the terminal cisternae just happen to be a little bit bigger. All right, so that's how a nerve impulse flows over the whole cell and actually enters this particular muscle cell. So here is a really good description of excitation-contraction coupling. Here we see a somatic motor neuron, a nerve impulse, right, will come down here, which is what, an action potential in motion. And the action potential comes down to the terminal button, and that opens calcium channels, so calcium enters the terminal button. That causes these vesicles to fuse with the presynaptic membrane, causes release of neurotransmitter into the neuromuscular junction. And since this is a skeletal muscle, you could tell me exactly what neurotransmitter that is, because it is always one all the time, and that is acetylcholine, right? And then you probably notice, well, here are some ligand-gated channels. And I see that it has two parts to it. There's one on the right, one on the left. So this one here can bind or has to bind two acetylcholine molecules to change state, to go from an open to a closed, from a closed to an open state. What kind of acetylcholine receptor are you aware of that has to bind two acetylcholines? It is a nicotinic type receptor, right? And that probably should remind you of a nice nicotinic receptor. Maybe it even says on the slide over here someplace. Okay. And that causes a graded potential, right? Because sodium is going to enter the cell. So that's going to depolarize the membrane. But look what else you have within the neuromuscular junction or the motor end plate. You have voltage-gated channels. So as soon as there are any graded potentials produced by acetylcholine, it's going to cause these voltage-gated channels to open up, and that is what is going to produce and propagate an action potential, right? So these ligand-gated channels produce graded potentials, but they don't have to travel very far because even within the neuromuscular junction, there are voltage-gated channels, and that is always going to cause are always going to trigger an action potential that will always excite skeletal muscle. So that's another reason why when you tell a skeletal muscle to contract, it can't just sit there and say, no thanks. It just has to because of these voltage-gated channels over the whole surface of the muscle cell, including the T-tubules. Here are some voltage-gated channels. So an action potential will move down through the T-tubule. And we see some other components within the T-tubule. There are what we call DHP receptors here and here. These are voltage-gated channels, and they change conformation, and they're coupled to another kind of receptor that's in the membrane of the smooth endoplasmic reticulum, and these things are what we're going to call ryanodine receptors. So when the DHP receptor is excited, it pulls on the ryanodine receptor that opens up calcium channels, and calcium then rushes out of the smooth endoplasmic reticulum or the sarcoplasmic reticulum, and the calcium floods all of these spaces between actin and myosin. And when you have calcium around actin and myosin, what's the next step? What would happen next when you have calcium? You can have cross-bridge formation taking place. And why do you have cross-bridge formation taking place when there's calcium? What is calcium going to associate with? How is calcium going to cause contraction? Calcium has got to bind to something. What is it going to bind to?
Troponin.
It's going to bind to troponin, right? And when it binds to troponin, it pulls tropomyosin out of the way, and then the myosin head group can actually bind to the actin molecule. And when calcium concentration starts to decrease, right, then tropomyosin covers up the sites for myosin binding, and the muscle starts to relax. Because remember, these calcium ATP pumps are working all the time. They're pumping, right? And so calcium is going to be put back into this sarcoplasmic reticulum, and only under the conditions when this ryanodine receptor is triggered will there be more calcium leaving than being pumped back into the cell. And as a matter of fact, there are calcium-induced calcium release channels that are huge. They're 10 times the size of a normal ion channel. Right, so the calcium pumps can't keep up pumping calcium from the cytosol into the sarcoplasmic reticulum still. There's much more calcium leaving when an action potential moves down the T-tubule. All right, so what you learned with neurons is really important to understand excitation-contraction coupling, right? Because the big difference is in a neuron, you don't have voltage-gated channels anywhere near a synapse. Where do you first see voltage-gated channels on a neuron? You ever see it on a dendrite? No, not on a cell body, only on an axon, right? But here with a muscle, right, you find them just back to back. Okay. All right, so we talked about that slide already. So here is the scheme for excitation-contraction coupling. You got an action potential reaching the axon terminus, right? That releases acetylcholine. That binds to receptors on the skeletal muscle membrane. And these are what? Ligand-gated channels or chemically gated channels. Sodium diffuses in because it's a nicotinic channel. And that depolarizes the skeletal muscle. And because there are voltage-gated channels right within the neuromuscular junction, that causes an action potential, right? And that action potential is just propagated over the whole surface of the muscle cell. And what can you tell me about an action potential when it's in motion from one end of the muscle cell to the other? What's the difference in an action potential? Or an action potential inside of a T-tubule compared to the surface of the muscle cell? They're always the same, right? It travels without decrement. It propagates without decrement. Okay, then once inside the transverse tubules, right, these DHP receptors, I don't care if you know the dehydropyridine receptors, DHP is fine, okay, causes them to become activated. That opens up voltage-gated calcium channels. Oops, I guess I can't slide that over. And that is going to then work with the ryanodine receptor and calcium-induced calcium release channels to open up these huge channels in the sarcoplasmic reticulum. So calcium just rushes out of the sarcoplasmic reticulum, floods all the way around all of the myofilaments where it binds to troponin, and troponin pulls tropomyosin out of the way. Then myosin can attach to the actin molecule, and if there's ATP involved, then that cross-bridge can cycle. And it can flex and extend, and pull actin over the myosin molecule. So that's the excitation-contraction coupling mechanism and why calcium is necessary. Muscle relaxation is just explained by calcium concentration. When there is no action potential in a T-tubule, then those ryanodine receptors close. But the calcium pumps are always pumping, and so they're then pumping calcium from around the myofilaments back into the smooth endoplasmic reticulum, and then calcium is released from troponin, and when calcium is released from troponin, tropomyosin gets in the way again of binding of the myosin head group, and the muscle relaxes as a result of that. Okay. All right, well, let's talk about maybe something that can be confusing a little bit. Let's go back to this slide right here. Right? We know that when somebody passes away, eventually, okay, the body experiences something we call rigor mortis. What is rigor mortis? Can anybody describe rigor mortis? Okay, that's when your muscles contract and they don't relax. How is it when somebody has passed away that their muscles can stay contracted? So we have to look at this figure here to understand that. So when somebody passes away, then their cells lose the ability to make ATP because blood isn't flowing through their body anymore. So all the mitochondria stop making ATP, ATP concentrations start to decrease, it gets used up. And so let's look at this figure here. Why is it that a muscle can't relax if there is no longer ATP inside of a cell? Look at this step right here. Very good, I heard it. So here we see myosin has attached to actin, right? And in this condition, actin and myosin can't slide over each other, right? It can't go back to a resting condition. It's just in a contracted condition, right? And when this ATP is used up, then there cannot be release of myosin from actin. It's going to stay in this contracted form when there is no ATP available. Right, so this illustration right here also explains that condition of rigor mortis. So ATP is necessary for what? Dissociation of myosin from actin, right? And not contraction. Okay. And contraction or the power stroke is a result of inorganic phosphate release from the myosin head group. Okay, I think some of the stuff, the next part in this chapter, some of the stuff you've looked at quite a bit in lab. So here we have a graph of something versus time. And it's labeled a twitch. So what does this kind of remind you of? What does this twitch remind you of? It sort of reminds me of an action potential. But what is a graph of an action potential? It is what versus time? An action potential is? Well, potential means voltage, right? So action means a change in voltage. So an action potential is voltage versus time. But a muscle twitch, what are we looking at? Are we looking at voltage versus time plot right here? It is actually tension, the amount of tension that a muscle produces when it's contracting versus time, right? So it's not a voltage. But it's actually how much the muscle is contracting, how much force is being produced. That is a muscle twitch. All right, and the other thing that you might notice is that the first twitch doesn't produce quite as much tension as the second twitch. All right, so these twitches right here are producing different amounts of tension, but if these were action potentials, what could you tell me about the amplitude of these two events? They would be exactly the same. Right, so please, when you look at this, don't think this is an action potential. This is just how much force we're measuring from a muscle when it contracts. So unlike an action potential, if muscle is stimulated rapid enough, you can see that the second twitch is stronger than the first one, and we call that summation. All right, so twitches can summate, and so muscles can produce graded contractions, unlike action potentials. Right? And we explain that by saying that by the time the second twitch comes along, there is still some residual calcium within the myofibril that is causing some contraction. And then when the second twitch comes, right, then just more calcium is added around the myofibril, and that produces a stronger contraction as a result of that. All right, so twitches can summate because they're not action potentials. So here we have a graph of strength of contraction versus time, which is what we had here. We had strength of contraction versus time, or tension versus time. Now on the next slide, it's that same graph of tension versus time. And so we said that twitches can summate. So in this, so we have three different circumstances. And so we have hooked up a stimulator to a muscle, and we can control how many electrical shocks are applied to this muscle to cause it to contract. And we can see that after the first contraction, before it completely relaxes, the muscle is stimulated again with an electrical stimulus, and it contracts a second time. And notice that the second contraction is stronger than the first. And how would you understand why is the second contraction stronger than the first? Why is it that they can summate? Because there's still some leftover calcium. It hasn't all been pumped back into the sarcoplasmic reticulum, right? It takes a little while to do that. And then before the second contraction completely relaxes, or before all the calcium is pumped back into the sarcoplasmic reticulum, it's stimulated once again, right? And so now we see an increasing slope of contraction, strength of contraction, even though there is some relaxation between these electrical stimuli. Right. This is when it reaches a plateau, that's what we call tetanus. So the muscle can't contract any stronger than this level right here. And when a muscle is in tetanus, is it relaxing? What happens to the tension? Does it ever go to zero? When a muscle's in tetany, can you see right here? It never goes to zero. It stays at this plateau region. I see some little variation. I see a little bit of relaxation. And if there's a little bit of relaxation, we call that incomplete tetanus. But nonetheless, that variation is right around the maximum contraction for that particular muscle. If we increase the frequency of electrical stimuli to this muscle, right, then we can cause a contraction, right, way sooner than in this previous condition, and so the muscle doesn't have the same amount of time to relax. Right, so if we look at 10 shocks per second over here, we still see some muscle fiber relaxation taking place. It's just not a solid line, right? But it reaches this plateau much more quickly. But because the muscle is still relaxing even just a little bit, we call this incomplete tetanus. But if we increase the rate at which electrical impulses are applied to a muscle, in this last particular case, we're going to say 60 shocks per second, right? Look what happens. The muscle does not relax at all because calcium is just flooding through the myofibrils, right? It's never pumped back into the sarcoplasmic reticulum. And when the tension curve is completely flat at a maximum, we call that complete tetanus. There's no relaxation taking place, right? Now, how long does that last? How long does complete tetanus last on this particular illustration? For the whole period of time that the stimulus is on, or does it start to change? I see that the force of contraction starts to decrease after a certain period of time. So the muscle, in this case, is getting weaker. Can you have the appreciation of that? The muscle is getting weaker even though we're stimulating it to the same degree. That's what we call fatigue. And there can be different kinds of fatigue. There can be physiologic fatigue and psychological fatigue. Let's talk about psychological fatigue first. Say, maybe some of you have experienced this, maybe riding a bicycle or hiking, okay, and during the day your leg muscles get a little bit weaker. Notice they're not quite so strong. Or maybe some of you have lifted weights, and when you first start lifting weights in the gym, your muscles are really nice and strong, but after a number of repetition, and we're talking about just a couple minutes, but not months or weeks apart, but just within a couple minutes, the muscle fatigues and you can't lift that heavy weight anymore. So what's going on there? If it's psychological fatigue, right, when you're lifting weights, what are you experiencing? I mean, you're seeing that weight move around. That's cool. But what else are you experiencing? How about some pain in that muscle? Right, so you feel discomfort in that muscle because there isn't oxygen getting to that muscle. And so psychological fatigue is just due to pain that develops when a muscle is used. So that's psychological fatigue. Physiologic fatigue is due to changes in the biochemistry of the muscle. When a muscle contracts, it becomes more acidic. And that changes how the muscle can contract. And when a muscle is contracting, it uses up ATP, and it produces ADP, and it produces inorganic phosphate. And the change in all those different chemicals, right, will then change the ability of that muscle to contract to that maximum degree. So that is a physiologic fatigue. So when a muscle is completely contracted, we see in this case, when it's complete, there's complete tetanus, blood can't get into that muscle. What other biochemical are you aware of that is being produced when oxygen can't get to a muscle, but it's working? Lactic acid, that's right. So lactic acid concentrations increase. That inhibits muscle contraction. That produces a physiologic fatigue. That also changes the pH of the muscle. That produces a physiologic fatigue, so the muscle isn't quite as strong. So there are a couple reasons why a muscle will fatigue. Right? But a muscle in a test tube will fatigue all by itself because it changes in the biochemistry. But if it's a whole person that is exercising, then there is physiologic fatigue, but there is also psychological fatigue as well. Okay. Why am I going backwards? I'm not sure why I know that is there. Okay, next concept in this chapter is called the length-tension relationship. And this is sort of interesting for skeletal muscle, but this is going to be hugely important for cardiac muscle. So I do want you to understand the length-tension relationship in skeletal muscle because we're going to use it to understand how our cardiovascular system operates. And what's the structural and functional unit in skeletal muscle? Sarcomere, right? And so all these sarcomeres line up. So if you look at a skeletal muscle underneath a microscope, how does it look? It looks striated, okay? And you know that there are two other kinds of muscle besides skeletal. There's cardiac and smooth. Is there another kind of muscle that's striated? Cardiac muscle. I heard cardiac muscle. You're right. What about smooth muscle? No. Okay. So because cardiac muscle is striated, it has sarcomeres as well. And so we're going to have to look at a sarcomere to understand something about this length-tension relationship, which just means that when the length of a muscle or the length of a sarcomere changes, then that's going to change the amount of tension that particular sarcomere can produce. All right, so the tension that's produced by a sarcomere is going to be related to the length of the sarcomere when it starts to contract. All right, so what are some other things that affect the strength of contraction? Well, we saw that it's influenced by the frequency of stimulation, right, because muscle twitches can summate. The thickness of each muscle fiber, right, and what's a muscle fiber again? Muscle fiber is a cell. So when a muscle cell gets bigger in diameter, what does that really mean when it gets bigger in diameter? Let me flip back a couple slides. What fills up? So here is a muscle fiber, and when it gets bigger in diameter, say instead of being a circle here, right, it's a huge big circle like this. What does that mean? When a muscle cell gets thicker, there are more? Yeah, there's more actin and myosin inside the cell because there are more myofibrils. Right? So the cell adds myofibrils as it gets thicker and stronger. And if there's myofibrils that are being added, then of course there is more actin and myosin inside the cell. So a really weak, small muscle fiber might have one myofibril, but a really strong, thick muscle cell will have many, many dozens of myofibrils in it, okay? And that will make that muscle stronger. So the thickness of a muscle, of the muscle fiber, influences the amount of tension or the strength of that particular muscle fiber. And then here is something that's not really intuitive, right? I think the first two are kind of intuitive. We saw because of tetanus, and you can think in terms of myofibrils inside of a muscle cell. But the initial length of a muscle fiber will also determine the strength that can be produced by that muscle fiber. And as a matter of fact, there is an ideal resting length in which that can generate the maximum force. So if we stretch a muscle out, sometimes it gets stronger. And so let's take a look at that relationship. Oh, I guess I went backwards. Yeah, okay, here's the length-tension relationship. So we're looking at a graph. We see some sarcomeres here down at the bottom. You can see that as we move from left to right, what happens to the sarcomere? It gets stretched out, right? So it gets stretched out. The actin and myosin molecules are exactly the same length, but the length of the sarcomere changes because the filaments slide over each other, right? And that's what's depicted in the graph above it. So this graph is just a plot of tension versus the resting length of a muscle before it contracts. So we're going to measure the length of a muscle before it contracts and then have it contract and then measure what the maximum tension that can be produced as it is contracting from different states of relaxation in the beginning. And does this look like a flat curve? Does this look like that no matter how we stretch the muscle, it will always produce the same tension when it contracts? No, because I see some variation in the amount of tension that is being produced by this muscle fiber depending on what? The resting length of that particular muscle. So this is the typical length-tension relationship. This is what we call the ascending limb. Here is the maximum. This is the optimal length of a sarcomere when it contracts to produce the most tension possible. And then as we stretch that muscle out even further, if we elongate the sarcomeres, what happens to tension? It starts to decrease. So let's take a look at why that happens at this molecular level. Well, what do we know? When a muscle or when a sarcomere contracts, there has to be an association between myosin and actin, right? Okay. And if we stretch this muscle or if we stretch this sarcomere, we might get to a point to where, what can you tell me about the overlap between myosin and actin? When we stretch this muscle out, there is no overlap, right? So there are no cross bridges that can form when a muscle is stretched out, okay, to 160% of its normal resting length. So there has to be overlap between actin and myosin. And so if we let this muscle go back to its normal resting length here, I see a nice overlap between actin and myosin, and now cross bridges can form, and actin can be pulled over to the center of the sarcomere. Right. Now let's make the sarcomere even shorter. Let's bring these Z discs together. Right. When we bring the Z discs together, when the muscle is at rest, not producing any tension, look, the sarcomere length is the length of the myosin molecule, and the myosin molecule can't get any shorter. And so because this myosin molecule can't get any shorter, the Z discs can't get any closer together either. Right? And since actin and myosin can't slide over each other, right, because myosin can't slide because it's held up against these Z discs over here, this sarcomere, in this case, can't produce any tension either. Right? So when the muscle sarcomere is really short, it produces no tension. As we start to stretch it out, then we begin to have some area to where the sarcomere can contract. The tension increases. Right, and then when there's optimal overlap between actin and myosin, that gives us the most tension when a muscle contracts. And then if we stretch a muscle even further, right, then we're decreasing the amount of overlap between actin and myosin, and those head groups can't generate the same amount of force by pulling on an actin molecule until eventually when there is no overlap whatsoever, then this sarcomere can't produce any tension because there could be no sliding of myofilaments. So on either side of these extremes right here, myosin and actin can't slide over each other. When there's no overlap, they can't slide over each other. When there's complete overlap between them and the sarcomere is the length of a myosin, then the filaments can't slide over each other as well. And if filaments can't slide over each other, what kind of tension does that produce? That produces zero tension. Okay. So athletes do take advantage of this. They might stretch a little bit before an exercise, and that will increase the strength of a muscle for them. As long as they don't do what? Overstretch, because then a muscle will get weaker as a result. All right, so that's the length-tension relationship. This is going to be really important for the heart because guess what happens to the heart when it starts to fill up with blood? It starts to stretch. That's right. So there is an optimal amount of blood that is used to fill the heart up that gives the heart its optimal strength. And if it overfills, if the heart overfills, what happens to it? It gets weaker. Yeah, the heart gets weaker as it overfills. And if it doesn't fill enough, it's weak as well. Okay? All right, So blood needs to fill the heart to stretch those muscles out so they're strong. But what happens, for instance, if somebody hurts themselves and they start to hemorrhage and they lose a lot of blood? So if we have a lot of blood running out on a sidewalk instead of going back to the heart, what happens to the heart? It doesn't stretch quite so much. And if we look at this length tension relationship. If the heart doesn't stretch, what happens to the force of contraction of the heart? It starts to decrease, right? The heart gets weaker and weaker and weaker as a result of that. Okay, we're going to have to revisit that and talk about another extreme, and that is when we have too much blood volume. Okay, what about neural control of skeletal muscle? Well, the motor neuron cell bodies are in the ventral horn of the spinal cord, right? The axons leave the ventral root. You might have to open up your anatomy book to have a nice picture in your mind of this thing. Okay, and then they move down, move out of the spinal cord into the spinal nerve, and that neuron moves all the way to the skeletal muscle. Sometimes we call that a lower motor neuron. And it's a final common pathway because there are many neurons that send signals to that somatic motor neuron. And so muscle contraction can be influenced by input to that lower motor neuron from sensory receptors that are contained in skeletal muscle and also in tendons. So some of these reflexes are facilitatory and some are inhibitory depending on how they influence the motor neuron going to a skeletal muscle. So there are two ways that feedback is involved with control of muscle. One is based on the length of a muscle or the stretch of a muscle, and the other is measured from tension, how much force is being produced by a particular muscle. Length is measured by something we call a muscle spindle apparatus. And the tension is measured by something that we call a Golgi tendon organ. Golgi tendon organs are in tendons. The muscle spindle apparatus is inside of a muscle. All right, so this gives information as to what the length of a muscle is and what the tension of a muscle is. And remember, all of these have set points. And if the tension of a muscle is different from the set point, then the spinal cord is going to make a decision on what to do to that muscle to get it back to the set point, right? Or to protect that particular muscle. And the same thing for tension. So here is a muscle spindle apparatus. It's embedded in the skeletal muscle. So here's a skeletal muscle. This could be a nice bicep, right? Or coracobrachialis or whatever. And you know that this is skeletal muscle because I see striations, and embedded in the skeletal muscle is the spindle apparatus. And do you see any sarcomeres in the spindle apparatus?
No.
What about all these striations right here? What does that mean? There are sarcomeres, right? So there are components of the muscle spindle apparatus that can contract as well. So there are two different kinds of fibers. These outside the muscle spindle are what we call the extrafusal fibers. These are the ones that produce tension when a muscle contracts. And these muscle fibers, or the modified muscle fibers inside the muscle spindle apparatus, we are going to call these the intrafusal fibers. And we can see that here is a nerve impulse innervating the intrafusal fibers. Here is a nerve innervating the extrafusal fibers. So what can you tell me about these nerves right here? Are these afferent or efferent? Efferent, right? Because they're sending electrical impulses to these muscles, causing them to contract. So these are motor fibers. The motor fibers that go to the usual muscle fibers that we're considering, or the extrafusal fibers, we're going to call that an alpha motor neuron. And the ones that go to the intrafusal fibers, we're going to call that the gamma. So we got alpha and gamma nerve fibers. Usually both of these are activated at the same time. So when a muscle contracts, the gamma motor fiber causes the muscle spindle to contract as well. Inside the muscle spindle, what do you see? What kind of nerve fibers do you see here? Are these afferent or efferent? They're afferent, right? Because they're sending signals back to the spinal cord. So these are stretch receptors. So when the spindle starts to stretch, it's going to send action potentials to the spinal cord. Then the spinal cord is going to know that this muscle spindle apparatus is stretching. All right, so how does this work? All right, so let's think of a condition which doesn't happen, right? But it's a good place to start. Let's just say that the muscle was told to contract. So there are nerve impulses that go down the alpha motor neurons, but there are no impulses that go down to the spindle apparatus. So it does not contract. Its length remains long, right? If a muscle doesn't contract, it still stays really long, doesn't produce any tension. And if the skeletal muscle here contracts, okay, means gets shorter, then there is really no change in tension of the muscle spindle apparatus. It stays long. And then if by some happenstance, all of a sudden the muscle starts to stretch, not because of some voluntary action, but involuntary action, the muscle starts to stretch, but the muscle spindle apparatus is really long, okay, does the muscle spindle stretch at all if it hasn't contracted? If the muscle spindle stays long and the skeletal muscle starts to stretch, then the muscle spindle apparatus can't tell that the muscle is stretching. That's the first condition. Let's compare it with the second one. If both the alpha and gamma fiber, right, send nerve impulses to the extrafusal and intrafusal fibers so that the intrafusal fibers contract along with the skeletal muscle, right, as soon as something starts to stretch the skeletal muscle, right, now because the spindle apparatus is short, that's going to pull on the spindle apparatus. And that pulling on the membranes of these cells will send action potentials to the spinal cord, telling the spinal cord that that your muscle is stretching when you don't want it to stretch. Right? But the muscle spindle apparatus has to contract to the same degree as the skeletal muscle in order for that information to be sent. If it stays really long, then it doesn't really matter if there is additional tension applied to either end of the muscle spindle apparatus because it's already in a long, relaxed state. It's only when the spindle apparatus is contracted to the same degree as the rest of the muscle, right? When the rest of the muscle is stretched, then the muscle spindle apparatus is stretched as well. So we call that co-activation. So the muscle spindle apparatus is co-activated with the skeletal muscle, right? Because there are nerve impulses that are sent down through the alpha fiber and the gamma fiber together. Okay, so I want you to know a little bit about that anatomy of that muscle spindle and what kind of event is being measured by a muscle spindle. I used it a lot, the term, and that is stretch. So the muscle spindle apparatus can measure stretch. That's what its job is. Okay. So let's look and see how that happens. Here we see a nice muscle in your thigh. Let's just call this the rectus femoris muscle. And you can see here is the tendon of the rectus femoris. It attaches to the patella, and then here's the patellar ligament between the patella and the tibial tuberosity. And this muscle is contracted, right? Our muscles are contracted to some degree all the time. So maybe you're sitting in a chair and your knee is bent, and your quadriceps are contracted a little bit just to protect your knee joint. And then somebody comes along with this hammer, right, and hits you on the patellar ligament. So that puts a lot of tension on the patellar ligament, which pulls on the patella, which pulls on the tendon of the quadriceps, right? And when we put tension on the tendon right here, that's going to pull on the skeletal muscle and stretch the skeletal muscle. So what organ inside of a skeletal muscle can measure that stretch? It's the spindle apparatus, okay? And are there signals from your spinal cord, right, telling this quadriceps muscle to relax or to be stretched? Right? Are there signals from your spinal cord that are operating this little hammer right here? No, because this is being held by somebody else, right? So your spinal cord thinks that this muscle should be contracted a certain amount and should be at a certain length. And then all of a sudden something comes around, like this hammer right here, and stretches the skeletal muscle. Right? The muscle spindle apparatus will be able to monitor that because all of a sudden it gets stretched because it has been co-activated with the extrafusal fibers. So it starts to stretch, and it sends afferent signals into the spinal cord, and that sensory neuron synapses directly on that lower motor neuron, or somatic motor neuron, which goes back to the skeletal muscle. And what can you tell me about this motor neuron going to a skeletal muscle? Can it inhibit a skeletal muscle or only excite a skeletal muscle? Yeah, because it's a voluntary muscle. This neuron right here is always going to be excitatory. So when the spindle apparatus is stretched, right, unexpectedly by this hammer right here, a nerve impulse goes into the spinal cord, and then impulses are sent down through the lower motor neuron, causing this muscle to contract. And so then, what's going to happen to your leg over here when there are nerve impulses on this somatomotor neuron? You're going to kick, right? It's going to cause this muscle to contract. So what was the initial stimulus? What was the initial stimulus here? Was stretch of this muscle, right? And that's an unplanned stretch, right? Your mind didn't know about it. Spinal cord didn't know about it, right? It's something that should not happen under normal circumstances, right? But all of a sudden, this muscle starts to stretch, measured by the spindle apparatus. So the stimulus was stretch, but what is the response? The response is not further stretching, but contraction. And what can you tell me, how does stretching and contraction relate to each other? Do they add together or do they subtract from each other? They subtract from each other. So this is a way of maintaining proper muscle length to prevent overstretching of a muscle. Because, for instance, when you're sitting in a chair right now, you don't want your muscles all of a sudden start stretching without your thought, because what would happen if all of a sudden all your muscles started stretching? Well, you'd fall right off your chair. Okay? So here is a way to maintain proper muscle tone, muscle tension in a muscle by measuring the amount of stretch within a muscle. And this is what we call a monosynaptic reflex, because there's only one synapse. Right, so your spinal cord has made a decision for you to contract the skeletal muscle. So in this sense, is skeletal muscle always under voluntary control? Voluntary control, yes, right? Because you can cause this quadriceps to contract by thinking about it. But here's a circumstance, right? A reflex happens automatically, even without your conscious thought, because you know what? You can't think with your spinal cord. Right, your appreciation and thinking processes are in your cerebrum. So this is a very fast mechanism that happens without your conscious thought to protect your joints and muscles from stretching when, right, that's an inappropriate kind of motion. That's what we call the knee-jerk reflex. So knee-jerk is a monosynaptic reflex. Okay, that can be inhibited. For instance, if you know somebody is going to hit you on the patellar ligament right here with a hammer, and you see it happening, and you're determined not to have this reflex happen, you can inhibit it because there are signals that come down from the cerebral cortex and synapse on this lower motor neuron right here. So that's why we call this the final common pathways, because this neuron gets information from other parts of your body, not just the stretch receptor or muscle spindle apparatus. Golgi tendon organs are not in a muscle, but they're in tendons. And they're not stretch receptors, they're tension receptors. And they produce a reflex that might be a little similar, but we're going to call this a disynaptic reflex. All right, so let's think of a little scenario with this muscle right here. This muscle is contracting because I called somebody up. I needed help moving a refrigerator, because I can't lift the refrigerator all up by myself, right? Probably nobody else in here can either. All right, so me and my friend are moving this refrigerator out of my house, so we're holding up this big refrigerator, and so our muscles are working pretty hard holding up that refrigerator, and then all of a sudden my friend loses his grip on the refrigerator, right, and it slips out of his hand. Now who's left holding up the whole refrigerator? I'm left holding up the whole refrigerator, but can I? I can't, because it's going to rip my tendons off of my bones, right? It's going to rip muscles. All right, and before I even know that that's happening, the Golgi tendon organ can then sense that there's this huge increase in tension that's being placed on my muscle, right? And that's going to destroy, right, or rip a tendon or rip a muscle. And so here is the Golgi tendon organ sending information into the spinal cord. So what kind of neuron is this? Is this afferent or efferent? Afferent, right? So there's a nice dorsal root coming in. This is what we call a disynaptic reflex, because here is a neuron completely within the central nervous system. What do we call a neuron within the central nervous system? Interneuron. So here's an interneuron. It becomes stimulated, but this is an inhibitory neuron, right? So it releases an inhibitory neurotransmitter on this motor neuron, somatic motor neuron, and if it inhibits this motor neuron, what's going to happen to this muscle here? It's going to relax, right? And because of this inhibition, then when the muscle relaxes, then that protects my body from ripping these tendons and muscles apart when they experience an overload in tension, right? So that's good. It protects my body, but what happens to the refrigerator? It gets dropped on the floor, hopefully not on your toe. All right, so the Golgi tendon organ is different than the muscle spindle. The muscle spindle measures stretch. It maintains the proper length of a muscle, but the Golgi tendon organ monitors tension, and it prevents over-tension, over-application of tension on a skeletal muscle and the tendons associated with that muscle. Okay, so that's all we're going to say about skeletal muscle. And here is cardiac muscle. How do you know this is not smooth muscle? Yeah, because I see striations. How do you know this is not skeletal muscle? A couple different ways. What's maybe one way? I see, they're short. Here's a muscle cell from here to here. It's short, and it's also branched, right? You see these branches? Skeletal muscle is long and linear. Doesn't have any branches, right? And it's not short. So what's the specialization that muscle is for? What can it do that other cells can't? What is it for? What is muscle for? I think I kind of hear it. It's for contraction, right? Muscle is specialized for contraction. So when this cardiac muscle cell is excited or stimulated, it's going to contract, and so is this one next to it, which means that they want to pull apart from each other. Right, and since this is cardiac muscle, if they pull apart from each other, then you're going to have a hole in your heart. And what would that be like? Terrible, right? That would be a fatal event. So there are special things that glue these cells together so they don't pull apart. It's called an intercalated disc. So there are intercalated discs which glue the ends of these cardiac muscle cells together, but also within that intercalated disc, not only cannot the cells separate, but there is something called a gap junction, right? And that gap junction allows sodium to diffuse from high concentration in one cell to low concentration in a nearby cell. So as sodium diffuses into a nearby cell, what happens to the membrane potential on that nearby cell? The one that's associated via a gap junction to the first cell that we were thinking about. Okay, when sodium enters, what happens to the membrane potential? It depolarizes, which is excitation, right? So this just says, because of these gap junctions, when one cell in your heart depolarizes, that depolarization, because sodium can diffuse into a neighboring cell through a gap junction, the neighboring cell depolarizes, which then causes excitation of that neighboring cell, right? Which then does what? Causes depolarization in the next neighboring cell. So this is really important, because in order for the heart to pump blood, it has to contract as a unit. The whole heart has to contract in order to pump blood. If only the front of the heart pumped, it would pump blood to the back of the heart. And then when the back of the heart contracted, it would pump blood to the front of the heart, and blood wouldn't be going through your body, your circulatory system, right? So the heart has to pump as a complete unit, and because of these gap junctions, as long as one cell is depolarized in the heart, they all depolarize, and they all depolarize more or less together, And then heart, then blood can be ejected from the heart. Okay. So not only are the cells from right to left or from anterior to posterior stimulated into contraction, let's just use left to right, but what about the whole thickness of the heart wall? Why is it that the whole heart, as you go from a superficial region to a deep region in the wall of the heart, why do they all contract? Because look at these branches right here. The branching pattern allows electrical activity in a superficial layer of the heart to move to the deeper layers of the wall of the heart. So not only does the whole heart contract from apex to base, but also from epicardium to endocardium, from the top of the layer to the deepest layer inside the heart because of these branching patterns. So that's it. So this is a special kind of synapse. This is not a chemical synapse. We're going to call this what kind of synapse? I think we talked about it. This. So remember, a synapse is that structural and functional unit of communication between cells. So here are two cardiac cells that are communicating with each other, not via a neurotransmitter, but directly because of that electrical current set up by sodium. Remember, sodium is an electrolyte. So this is what we call an electrical synapse. So that electrical event can just flow from one cell to the next, right to left, but also from top to bottom because cardiac muscle cells are branched. That's really important. Now, would it be a good idea to have these electrical synapses in skeletal muscle? How come we don't have gap junctions in skeletal muscle? I heard no, and I like no. Why do you like no? Yeah, you would have uncontrolled contraction if that were the case. If all of our skeletal muscles had gap junctions like the heart, as soon as we reached out to have a drink of water, what would happen to all the skeletal muscles in our body? They would all contract, and then we would die of thirst, right? So, skeletal muscle is controlled by chemical synapses. Cardiac muscle is controlled by electrical synapses because it has to contract as a unit. It's just one big muscle in your chest. All right, so there are some differences between skeletal muscle and cardiac muscle, even though both have myosin and actin. Right? And calcium is important for contraction. That's an important signal for contraction in the heart, because heart muscle does have troponin, which interacts with tropomyosin and allows for cross-bridge formation to take place. Right, and it has T-tubules, just like skeletal muscle. But there's a little bit of a difference. There's no ryanodine receptor. Okay, so when an action potential goes down through a transverse tubule, that opens up voltage-gated channels, so there is some calcium from outside the cell that enters the cardiac muscle cell that is going to cause contraction. There's virtually no calcium outside the cell in a skeletal muscle that causes contraction. You could think of all the calcium for skeletal muscle contraction comes from the sarcoplasmic reticulum. But for cardiac muscle, contraction is partly controlled by calcium from an extracellular source and partly from a source from the sarcoplasmic reticulum. All right, so that's a little bit of a difference because there's no ryanodine receptor. There's just these calcium-induced calcium release channels so that when an action potential gets into a T-tubule, that opens up a calcium channel. That calcium that enters the cell interacts with this calcium-induced calcium release channel, and it causes them to open up, and these are huge, and so then calcium leaves the sarcoplasmic reticulum. And then it's the usual scenario that you're aware of, that calcium binds to troponin, gets tropomyosin out of the way, cross bridges can form, and hopefully there's really good reserves of ATP in the heart and these muscles can contract. When that action potential disappears, that causes these voltage-gated calcium channels to close, causes these calcium-induced calcium release channels to close. Right, this calcium ATP pump takes calcium away from troponin, puts it back into the sarcoplasmic reticulum, and then the heart muscle relaxes as a result of that. Right, so there is a little bit of difference between skeletal and cardiac muscle and where calcium comes from. Right, so the good thing to remember, calcium for skeletal muscle is completely from sarcoplasmic reticulum, but calcium in Cardiac muscle comes from sarcoplasmic reticulum, but also from the extracellular space. That's important. All right, the last thing we got to talk about here is smooth muscle, and I think we'll talk about that on Tuesday. But you could look this over, or maybe I'll put a lecture online. I'll let you know if I put a lecture online for smooth muscle. Okay. And here is a smooth muscle. Do you see sarcomeres? I don't see striations. No striations. The interesting thing is we still have myosin and actin. We still have cross bridges, but the way these things are arranged inside of a smooth muscle cell is completely different. I don't see any Z-discs. Okay, within a smooth muscle cell. All right, so we'll talk about that next time. The sign-in sheet is going around. So please sign the sign-in sheet. So Janice, did you work today?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. I hope you're feeling okay. Sort of.
Okay.
Yeah. That will help the symptoms, right? Yeah. That will help you get better faster too, probably, if you don't have so many symptoms.
A quick question about so for summation, if I was labeling it, will it be basically two of the spikes or just the second one?
Two of them being added together.
Oh, okay.